All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey, I'm Lisa and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. They give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And I have been asked to introduce a speaker tonight. Her name is Tracy Kelly, and she is a very good friend of mine. I met Tracy about 30 days into her sobriety, and she was an angry young lady. She had 30 days, and she asked me how much time I had, and I said 6 months. And she's like, God, I thought you had like 2 years. So automatically, I loved her, and because I was an old-timer all of a sudden. But we definitely, from that moment forward, have, you know, bonded over life and alcoholism. And she has such an amazing, amazing story and an amazing way to tell her story. She is a beautiful human being that has so much to offer, and I'm really grateful to know her. So here's Tracy.
Hey, you guys, I'm Tracy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Tracy.
Blue chip speaking is quite an honor. I wore blue in honor of that. But the idea that I would have a year or more of sobriety eluded me for an extremely long time. What an honor to be here. I love coming here because Tim is always so gracious. And I don't know if it's because I was asked to speak that all of a sudden I get these emails from him now that are so full of good stuff from all the literature. It's a lot of fun. So I'm ridiculously nervous. And so I want to start out with a joke because that just kind of lightens up the room a little bit, right? So you all have to promise to laugh at the joke. And that was the joke. And I have to let you know ahead of time that there's absolutely nothing, or maybe just a little bit, of what I have to say tonight that's original. It's all come from you. I heard everything, I've learned every single bit of it from you, including this joke. So there was a young woman in sobriety, and she was working with a sponsor. She was really having a lot of trouble with some of her sexual, maybe indiscretions, in her alcoholism. And so she asked her sponsor, where can I go and read about this in the Big Book? And her sponsor, being all-knowing, and one of those sponsors that knows all the parts of the Black Book, said, go home and read page 59. And so later that night, the young lady got home, very new into sobriety, and she sat down with the book, and she could not remember for the life of her what page she was told to read. She thought, oh my God, I thought maybe it was 69, but surely they're not going to talk about sex on page 69. So maybe she just inverted the numbers. And so she turned to page 96, and she read at the top of page 96. And here's what it said. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. That is from working with others, and it those are true words, but not in regards to your sexual indiscretions. Thanks for laughing. And after laughter, because we're not a glum lot, there's absolutely nothing glum about me today. But I do need to quickly just pray, because this is not, my story is not a laughing, it's not a laughing matter. And when I get up here, my ego takes over, and I want to look good, and I want to sound good, and I want to say all the right things, and I want to be memorable. And that's all ego, and I don't deal in ego anymore. I mean, I try not to. It's every day that I have to just turn it over and be humbled and remember that this is not about me at all anymore. That my story is no longer who I am. I turned myself over to the care of a God that I have come to know and love so dearly that I don't have to be my story anymore. So with that, just indulge me for a second, and I don't pray out loud very often, and so if it comes up kind of funny, you can laugh. Okay. God, I offer myself right here to you at this moment to do with me as you will. Please relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I can just better do your will and take away all my difficulties, any stuttering or repeating of things or nervousness, especially vomiting. I ask that you remove those things simply so that it's a witness to other people in this room that may hear this, of the power that you have had in my life, the change that has come in my life only because of my relationship with you. May I do your will for the next 30 minutes and for always. Amen.
Amen.
Okay, so the last time I had a drink was September the 12th, 2012. And that was a sip of wine. It was really more like a couple of gulps. And it was out of this aluminum bottle, which was covered in beautiful pink flowers. And I carried this bottle everywhere with me for maybe 2 years. And it was constantly filled with alcohol, wine most of the time. I loved this bottle because it had a pink screw on top, so you couldn't smell anything. And it definitely was not see-through. And I took it everywhere with me. It held an entire bottle of wine, and I filled it up multiple times every day. My last sip out of that bottle was in a hotel room with my mom in the shower, who had driven me 5 hours to a treatment facility in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, I'm not from there. I'm here. But there was no way I was going to be able to go to a rehab here because somebody might know me. And my mom was in the shower. I had saved just enough alcohol to drink a little bit before having to go into treatment. And I left that bottle in that hotel room, and I hope to never see it again. I have a sponsor. I have an amazing sponsor, and she has a sponsor. And so in that, I have, like, grand sponsors. And on top of that, I have a fellowship of women that are absolutely amazing. And if you don't have a sponsor that you love, that you talk to on a regular basis, you're missing out on a really big part of this program. I have a home group, which is awesome. It's called the Peace of Mind group, and that's what happens when I go there. I get a little peace of mind, and we meet on Mondays and Thursdays at 6:30 in Flowery Branch, which is in between, like, here and Gainesville. So if you're ever in between the two and you need to grab a meeting, we're a small group. We are absolutely not organized. It says so in the book that we should not be organized. And we have a lot of fun. We read right out of the literature. We have a big book study on Thursday nights. And then on Saturday mornings at 9:30, we laugh. We have an open discussion based on the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a blast. The idea of being part of a home group then puts me into service. And I have held a position in my home group. I host a step study with women in my home. I most recently have tried to expand my fellowship and include my husband, who's not a member of the program, and joined a traditions and relationships study with other people that are other couples that are in the program. And so I try to do several conventions and retreats and stay in the middle of the bed. And that keeps me sober. And sharing my story is a big part of that. So thank you for having me. I think that throwing all that stuff out there is great. It's good to hear. You have to do those things, right, if you want to be sober. And that's what we hear in the rooms all the time. But I need you to also understand that I have a God of my experience. And that's the thing that keeps me sober today. And for the longest time, I referred to that God as the God of my understanding. And I was at a retreat, and I heard a speaker say, you know, it's not the God of my understanding because I don't understand God. It's the God of my experience. And I loved that, and I adopted it. And that's what I know today. I know the God that leads me to this meeting with all these women that love me, that showed up and drove all this way. That's the God of my experience. Because today, for me, there are no coincidences. In my old life, that would have just been happenstance, or they would have wanted something, or there would be some excuse. But today, it's the God of my experience that brings me here and is going to have just an amazing story to tell you. I have alcoholism from, like, in the womb. I came out alcoholic. There's no question in my mind. I could not rightly relate to the world. And maybe you can understand that. But it started off in weird sort of ways. So, like, to this day, I can't eat a tomato unless the skin is peeled. My sweet husband does that. He peels the skin from my tomato. And, like, even as a young girl, maybe if you have kids you can relate, or maybe you have the same problem, like socks, the toe line of the socks, that would really bother me. I did not wear a pair of pants until well into fourth grade. I wore a dress everywhere I went, to the playground. I lived in the north, so it would be 30 below and I would be in a dress, because when you wear pants, I don't know if you guys have ever noticed this, but when you sit down, like, the zipper doesn't, like, it doesn't mold to your body. It has, like, a mind of its own. So when you sit down, the zipper kind of, like, it kind of, like, comes up a little bit. And I didn't like that because it made me feel like I had a penis. And I didn't want to have a penis. So pants gave me a penis. And I just thought my solution was just don't wear pants. And if that's not alcoholic, the starting of alcoholism, the solution is to just not wear pants. So instead of just saying, okay, your zipper sticks up a little bit, it doesn't mean you have a penis. Instead, it was, I'm not going to wear anything except a dress, and I don't care if I freeze my ass off. The concept of alcoholism taking all these different forms starts there, but it continues on. I lived in a world of drink. My entire family, they just consume alcohol. There are three admitted alcoholics in my family. One of them is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and has 25 plus years. The other one is me, and the third one is dead. But all of the rest of my family members drink alcoholically. None of them are admitted alcoholics, but I surround myself with them and all of their drinking my whole life. So I didn't know anything else. There was no one in my background, anywhere I could look, that was sober. I had no one to say, wow, you don't need alcohol. And my story growing up is one of happiness. Alcohol was fun. It brought out the best in my dad. It brought out the best in my mom. The whole family would get together, and laughter would be all you would hear, and drink in hand. And that's how it went for me. There were no real consequences. There was no fighting. There was just really happiness. And so I just thought that was a very normal way to live life, with alcohol. The first time I ever recognized that maybe it wasn't quite normal, I remember being in third grade, and my dad moved us around a lot. He wasn't military, but he was climbing the corporate ladder. And so I was born in Pennsylvania. We moved to Texas, back to Pennsylvania, to Georgia, back to Pennsylvania, to Ohio, back to Pennsylvania. So having friends was difficult. And I had one girl who was able to come spend the night. And I remember on a Friday night being outside, playing, having a good time. My parents next door doing what they do Friday night. They're drinking cocktails with the neighbors on the patio. And out of nowhere, this mom comes screaming across the yard and yelling at my parents, "How dare you take care of my daughter in this condition?" And she picked up her daughter and threw her over her shoulder, put her in the car, and they took off, and that child was not allowed to see me ever again. And I remember pointing at them and being like, "That's weird. You're strange. What's going on? That's not, drinking is fine." And that's how I rolled, really, all the way through my 39 years of alcoholism, was just like pointing at you if you didn't drink and wondering what in the hell was wrong with you. So my alcoholism, like, is always twisting and turning and taking these different sort of pathways. And I'm not thinking anything of it. I'm in love with my aunt, who is admitted alcoholic and dead. And I love her. I completely relate to her. She's fun. She's exciting, gregarious, outgoing. She lived in Fort Lauderdale. She was a lesbian. There were all these parties and women everywhere. And she had money, and life was great. And the real short of her story is that I watched her go from this really fun and exciting woman with tons of friends and lots of money and lots of life to her funeral, where there were literally four of us standing at the graveside at the age of 56. It stripped her of everything. And I watched her go down the whole time. And that, to me, to this day, is one key piece of my sobriety, because she showed me the ultimate gift in this program. She showed me what happens if I drink. And I love that, and I'm so grateful to her for that. As the drinking, I remember my first drunk at 13. Definitely did the whole drink to get drunk thing and knew I was going to do it forever. And that's just how it went down. I had some consequences when I was in high school. I was the manipulator, good at lying. You know how it goes. At one point, I remember getting pulled over for alcohol underage, and I just flat out lied about who I was. We just moved there, so I gave the name of this friend of mine in Texas, and everyone else got in big trouble, but I had given this fake name, and they couldn't find me in the records. And so as I laugh, they all lose their license, and ha 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 ha. About 6 months later, you know, my mistake was that I gave an actual name and an actual address, because I, you know, knew the girl. So they come knocking on my door. So I'm in front of a judge at 17 for lying about my identity. And so there were little consequences like that along the way. Off to college I go, because I need to get as far away from my parents as possible. I'm an independent woman. I can do it on my own. Come down to the University of Georgia and I drink. And I discover another form of alcoholism. And for me, that was bulimia. I began to binge and purge when I wasn't drinking. And in a strange sort of way, it would give me that same feeling, that same sort of like, I'm not in myself. I'm hovering sort of out there. And that was my life, and for a very long time was binging and purging, drinking, binging and purging, drinking. And when I say bulimia, it wasn't like, you know, it was 3-4 times a day, and then drinking on top of that, you know, almost every day. I still wonder, I look back, and it's only in looking back, because when I was in all of that, it was completely normal, absolutely nothing wrong with it. But I look back and I wonder how in the hell I got anything done. Because in the midst of all of that, I was getting a degree in psychology. I was specializing in addiction because my aunt was an alcoholic and she was going to die. And I met a guy and I got married and I had kids. And all this is going on. And I'm an active bulimic and an active alcoholic. And I'm not seeing any of it. Thinking it's completely and totally normal to have my 6-month-old daughter in the car and have a 4-pack of wine in the glove compartment so that after I'm done teaching for the day, I can have a couple of drinks before I have to pick up this wine kit. Completely normal. As this progresses and the drinking just continues, now I'm having a good time, you know, we're bonfire in the backyard, we're the neighborhood to be at, like everybody's hanging out with us, the kids are all having a blast, they're growing up around the exact same thing I'm growing up around. I can remember when I was trying to get sober one of many times, and I read somewhere that alcoholism runs in the family, but recovery can too. Recovery can run in the family. And I hold on to that because my daughter and my son need somebody to look at and say, you can live life without alcohol. Because still, in my family, I'm the only one. I'm the only person who doesn't drink almost every single day. And that's only because of the grace of God. Oh, wow. The alcoholism just continues. We're drinking all the time. My husband and I are now beginning to fight a lot because it's just constant alcohol. And I can remember, this is one quick story, is this is a bad one. We had a fight in the morning, and he's going to head down to Atlanta to go to a music festival. And that pisses me off because then I'm stuck at home alone with the kids. And so I set in my mind to get a babysitter, and I'm going to head out with my friends, but that's really going to suck because I'm going to have to drive myself. I was always really quick to say, not driving. Somebody else can just take that. But this time I had to count the drinks, and this is all in hindsight. Count the drinks, make sure I stopped an hour before when I couldn't drink. I was just going to smoke some pot. I get home, and my husband's not there yet. So I let my babysitter go. She lived across the street, cute little 13-year-old girl. And I get home, thank God I'm home, because now I can really have a nice glass of wine. Sit down with my nice glass of wine. I'm all ready to have my cigarette, my wine, and my phone rings. And it's my husband, and he tells me that he has been in a horrible car accident and is upside down on 985. And can I please help him? And then the phone goes dead. So what do? I call the babysitter. Can you come back over? I jump in the car. Now, I've only had a few drinks. I jump in the car, and I head southbound on 985. The accident was in between two exits, so I get to see the accident as I'm headed southbound, as he was headed north. And it's bad. The car's completely upside down, smashed in. His stuff is everywhere. Golf clubs, phones, everything scattered all over the road. I have to get off the exit, turn around, and I come pulling up behind the accident, and he's in the ambulance, and the ambulance is pulling out. So I jump out of the car, and I run over to the state trooper, and I'm like, oh my God, what happened? How's my husband? Is he okay? And the officer says, ma'am, have you been drinking? I mean, how many H's can you say to a state trooper when alcohol's on your breath? He puts me in the back of the car, and I'm dumbfounded. Like, this doesn't happen to me. I don't get DUIs. This is unheard of. And my 13-year-old babysitter is at home with my two kids, and my husband's dying in the hospital because I saw the car, and I'm absolutely sure that he's not alive right now. And they're going to take me to jail, and they don't care. And I'm saying nothing. And he's so busy trying to get me to talk and say something that he doesn't pursue my husband up to the hospital. So he gets up, Michael gets up there, and immediately refuses all care, jumps in the cab and gets home. So I took his DUI. Talk about some resentment. So it was at that point that he decided maybe this is enough, and he slows down on his drinking, and mine just skyrockets. I just take off because now you're an asshole, sorry, and I'm taking your DUI. I can't believe I've got a DUI. I'm going to lose my job, my career, everything I've ever worked for. Everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and this is terrible. I can remember the lawyer that I had telling me, why don't you just go out and do something for someone else? I had no idea what that meant at the time, and I'm like, who are you to tell me to go do something for someone else? Because I was calling her continuously, like, have you heard anything? What's going on? Because I was certain that the story in and of itself was going to get me off the hook, right? I mean, certain you get in the car to go see your husband who's upside down in the middle of 985. So they end up reducing it, but nonetheless, I go to the DUI school. I don't have a problem. Denial is so thick. The wall of denial is so thick and so tall that as I sit in the DUI class, there's wine in my car, and at lunch break, I go out and drink the wine. The woman who was teaching the class had to take my cell phone from me twice, and I'm not thinking a thing about any of it. So from there, the marriage gets really rocky, and we're headed for divorce, and I'm drinking all the time, and I realize I need to stop. So I start doing all those things that we do. All right, so I'm going to get in shape because I'm putting on too much weight. I'm going to run a half marathon. That's a great goal to have. So I'll quit drinking for that. And so I was okay. When I had kids, I could quit drinking. When I could need to get in shape, I could stop. But it got to the point where New Year's Eve would roll around, and I would be sure, okay, I'm going to give it up. And then I would remember that the Super Bowl comes after New Year's, and then after that's my birthday, and then there's Valentine's Day, and then I'll stop. But then there's St. Patrick's Day, and that one's really hard. And Easter, who doesn't have wine on Easter? And then there's spring break. I got a drink on spring break. And so I'll stop after that. But then there's summer, and I'm a school teacher. So you got to be at the lake and on the beach and at the pool, and you have to be drinking. And there was always something. And then there's Halloween, and then there's Thanksgiving. And it went like that for 2 years for me. Non-stop drinking, an excuse to not stop. And finally, when I had said, okay, this is enough, I have to get sober, I lied to my parents and asked them to please take my children to our family reunion. I was not able to attend because I needed to be with my husband. Complete lie. But I knew I could not get sober with my children in the house. Parenting without alcohol? Like, who does that? That's impossible. So she takes the kids, and my husband leaves town, and I curl myself up on the couch, and I almost die. I was consuming so much alcohol and other substances that I laid in a fetal position on my couch and watched Nurse Jackie, like every episode of Nurse Jackie, for 4 days. Almost died. Curled up in the fetal position, shaking. Not having any idea that I was going through that massive withdrawal. Cannot believe that I'm getting through it. Finally kind of break through the sweat and can get off the sofa, can stomach some food. And I begin to hover on line, AA online. And I remember thinking people being first name and last initial, like so dumb. Like if I'm going to chime in here, because all I did was hover. But if I'm going to chime in, I'm certainly going to have some like fun name, like Drinking and Driving Girl, or you know, something that's more like Tracy K. Like, all these people were duh, duh. So I hover there for a little bit, and my parents bring my children back to me, and I stay sober. I stay sober for 3 weeks. And it was the end of summer, and you have to celebrate the end of summer with just one drink. That's it. I'm just going to have just this one day of drinking. But that one day happened to consist of me being in charge of 4 children, driving them to Helen, tubing down the river, drinking the whole way, drinking on the road with the kids in the back all the way home, then getting more alcohol, like burning myself trying to cook them a frozen Tony's pizza. Just ugly, ugly alcoholism. And that was it. After that, I couldn't stop. I could not drink. And that scared me to death. I really tried. I would wake up in the morning and I would say in the shower, I'm not going to drink today. And the next thing I knew, I was kicking everybody out of the house to take my pink flowered bottle and pour a whole thing of wine in it and stash the bottle somewhere, put the pink top on it, and take it to school with me. At this point, I'm shaking so bad when I'm trying to write on the board that it has to be apparent to the students that I teach that something is wrong with me. And then the gall, the nerve, the self-centeredness that I'm bringing the alcohol into the school building to my desk and sitting it there and drinking it in between class changes. Who does that? Sweet little 13 and 14-year-old kids. Their parents have placed me in charge of them. At that point, I begin to, like, this is not good, Tracy. You're out of control. And I'm a pretty strong-willed individual. So I just decide that I'm just going to get through this school year drinking like this. And it just escalates. I've got the nerve to take the bottle to the lunchroom. I've got it sitting next to me in the lunchroom, opening it up, hoping nobody's smelling it. Still can't believe nobody could smell it. No one says a word to me. The irony is that very shortly after this, I go to rehab and I come back and I'm teacher of the year. Swear. And the just that concept in and of itself. So here's what sent me over the edge, was that I teach gifted kids, really smart, brilliant, amazing kids that are way smarter than me. And one of them happened to be the superintendent's kid. And he was in a terrible hunting accident on Labor Day weekend. And his cousin had shot his leg. And he was facing amputation. And I knew I had to go to the hospital, and I had to pay my respects and see the young man and his family, and his dad was the superintendent. So I have to not drink because I'm going to be in this small little hospital room with the superintendent of schools. I can't drink all day. I have to go in there sober. And that was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. And I walk into that hospital room, and there's this young boy sitting there facing whether or not he's going to cut off his leg. And I'm worried about getting back to my car so I can get alcohol. So the next day, I made some phone calls, found a treatment facility. And when I finally admitted the truth, I fell apart. I had no idea how I held it together that long, but once I finally let go, I looked like shit. Every single piece of me fell apart. Having to confess to my husband all the alcohol, where I was hiding it, what I was doing, all of the other substances that were going on, and then off to rehab I go. And I come back, and now I'm being held accountable because I chose to not go the insurance route. We decided to come out of pocket because my ego couldn't let anyone, it could never be on record that I went to rehab. So we pay for it out of pocket, and everybody's pretty pissed at me at this point, right? So I've stolen all their pills, I drank all their liquor, I've lied to them bold-faced. Like, that's not a good feeling, to be lied to the way that I lied to my family. So I'm doing 90 meetings in 90 days. And here's what happens to me. These women in the front row, they scoop me up and they hold on so tightly to me that I try to run almost every single day. I come in pissed off, upset, yelling at you, you're dumb, you're stupid, this is a cult, I hate it, there is no God, this is dumb, I don't even want to be here. And they never let me go, not for 1 second. I can remember thinking, how selfish of them, because in the rooms I would always hear that we sponsor because it keeps us sober. I don't sponsor women so that I can get them sober. I sponsor so that I can stay sober. I was like, they're just trying to stay sober. All they care about is themselves. I was not happy at all. And so I set off on a mission to prove that this program did not work. By God, I was going to do everything that was suggested, and then some, and then I was going to go back out, and I was going to drink like a normal person, and I was going to write a big article about how AA doesn't work. And what happened in the meantime was sobriety. What happened in the meantime is that I found a God of my experience. What happened in the meantime is that I developed a fellowship that was way more than alcohol. It's still hard for me. I struggle. But I heard early on that we all struggle. Any alcoholic struggles, but it's that struggle that creates the perspective that only an alcoholic can have. And I love that I know that perspective today, that I can see it. I can see my God stringing little pieces together, and I'm not sure where they're going to end. I used to have to know. I used to have to figure it out. But today I can just let it go and just see what happens. Because I trust today. I don't trust a human being. I trust this God that continues to show me that I can stay sober one day at a time. And it's the most amazing program in the world. I love that God is changing me. Like, you know, the person that is standing up here today is not at all the person that walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am completely and totally like 180 degree, maybe 360, but like not, because it's so much, but it's not right back where I started. It's unbelievable what this program has done for me. And it's because I do what I'm told. I do the things that are suggested, and I don't say no. I think I said no once. And then I felt so bad about that I had to go make amends. So the idea that I can be still today is super hard. I'm just coming off of spring break, right? That was party week. And my husband was ill, very ill, for like 7 days in the bed. And I was making living amends because I was there. I was present. That would be the best reason to just run out and drink, because he's all in the bed, you're gross and sick, I don't want to be around. But I was present, and I was in the home, and I was there. Now, he needed very little, which created quite a bit of boredom for me. And as an alcoholic, I get bored very easily. So that meditation piece has been huge for me. I love working in 11 because it helps me to be able to be still and not feel like I'm going to crawl out of my skin. But then what's cool is that every single day that I wake up, I am bombarded. Like, literally bombarded with 50 texts from all of the women in the fellowship. And I love that. And I used to need that manipulative sort of conversation with people, the gossiping piece, the what kind of trouble can we get in. That used to be what fulfilled me. And today, it's stuff like people sending me the word honest, courage, humility, God's will. And if that's not transformation, I don't know what is. I am so incredibly grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact that I'm sober today, I know, makes my aunt so incredibly proud. That she was the most special person, and this disease stripped her of her dignity and her life. And to stand here at a blue chip speaker meeting and have a year more under my belt is an absolute miracle, but it is not a coincidence. One of my grand sponsors made me memorize the foreword. Glad she's not here. to the 12 and 12, and it says that the 12 steps are, okay, whisper it louder, the 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, if when practiced, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happy and usefully whole. Usefully whole. Like, I came into this program full of holes, and I plugged them with cork bottle, just plugging them all the time, holes everywhere, H-O-L-E, holes everywhere, all over everywhere. And I found a holy God, H-O-L-Y, and he filled those holes. And now I get to put a W on the front of it and tell you that I'm whole. I'm W-H-O-L-E. And that's so amazing. And that is absolutely due to you guys. I needed this meeting today so badly because last week during spring break, that one meeting that I made because I was home, I had to take care of my sick husband and I had to make living amends and blah, 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 and all the excuses that we can give ourselves for not showing up for one meeting a week. And then there was the fact that I was going to have to speak, and I equated that to at least 5 meetings in my alcoholic mind. So I needed this meeting so badly, and this meeting doesn't happen if you don't show up. So I'm incredibly grateful. Thank you, guys.
Wow, that was great. Thank you so much for being here, Tracy. We've got Sonia to that street. Yeah. Y'all make it easy. They're right here. I'm Sonia, I'm a grateful alcoholic. Before I hand out the chips, Tracy, that was amazing. And I just want you to know Twyla is smiling right now. Thank you for that. I need to hear that. Here at the NABA, we have chip system. That marks your time in sobriety. The white chip is the international chip of surrender. It's when you're done or you want to pick up a white chip, join our way of life, or you've gone back out to add your story. Anybody need a white chip?
No. Okie doke. How about this really pretty silver 30-day chip? 30 days, anyone? Brad, 90 days? I'm going to have a resentment if somebody don't pick the chip. How about sunshiny yellow for 6 months? Okay, and the pregnancy chip in AA, the 9-month chip. Anybody? Okay, and then we have a blue chip. I believe there's going to be a blue chip tonight. Anyone?
Hey, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
4 years. It's a miracle. I just listen to other people. I don't do anything, just like what Tracy said. I follow the suggestions handed down to me. God does everything. It's divine intervention from beginning to where I am right now. God working through me, through you. Thanks.
Congratulations, Lisa. All right, one more time. Anybody sign in for the white chip? All right, well, thank God and your sponsors for the chip you know.
Thank you so much. I didn't realize Helen Mirren was
Thank you all for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Baby tonight.
Stop.